There was another cause of my distress at his long absence, which I didn't mention any more than the other. Ascanius's behavior while he was gone. Aeneas had left him in charge of the household and all affairs at Lavinium, as was right. The eldest son and heir should be getting experience in taking responsibility. Understandably, Ascanius found it frightening to take on his father's authority, was anxious, and overdid it. He ruled with a heavy hand. People were ready to take every excuse for his youth, but he was uncommonly tactless, even for a boy his age. He was hasty, willful, pompous. He sulked at any setback, and disdained any advice, even from Achates. Especially from Achates, perhaps, because Achates was so faithful a lieutenant and friend of Aeneas. Pining for combat in order to prove himself fearless, or fearing it, and therefore stumbling into it, I don't know which, Ascanius sought a quarrel wherever it could be found. In the month Aeneas had been gone, he had stirred up resentment and ill-feeling in almost every person or group he had had to deal with, done damage which would take months to repair. Try as I might, I couldn't forgive Ascanius for spoiling both the peace of his father's rule and his father's peace of mind. I so much wanted Aeneas's brief reign to be a true reward for all his travails, a haven of happiness. I longed to see my son of the evening star shine out at last in tranquility. While Aeneas was in Etruria, I had thought I should tell Ascanius what I knew, that his father's life hadn't much longer to run. Surely, if he knew that, natural piety would make him wish to spare his father trouble and grief, and his competitive spirit could control itself for a year or so. But Ascanius was so suspicious and jealous of me that I couldn't bring myself to trust him with that knowledge. He might even scoff at it. He tended to look down on all things Latin, including our oracles and sacred places, and I had heard him say that the best thing about the Greeks was that they knew how to keep women in their place. Though I told myself it was just a boy talking, and believed Ascanius had a good heart under all his bluffing and sulking, still I couldn't trust him with my knowledge. I couldn't trust him not to use it against Aeneas in anger or as a show of power. Ascanius and I kept out of each other's way as best we could. Aware now that his wife and son didn't get along, Aeneas was careful not to put either of us in a false position with the other. Though people often confuse it with weakness or duplicity, tact is a great quality in a ruler, whether of a country or a household. Awareness of the other allows respect, and people respond to it, returning the recognition and the respect. Aeneas governed with tact and was beloved for it. He had to exercise it actively that winter and spring, mending fences with landowners and tribesmen and neighboring peoples whom Ascanius had offended, including my father. Rebellious as Ascanius might be, his pride in his ancestry and father was as naive as a child's, and he simply couldn't accept the doddering old chieftain of a province on the far western edge of the world as an equal, let alone as his king. During Aeneas's absence, he had dismissed a messenger from Latinus without answer and had issued orders contrary to Latinus's orders. My father said nothing at the time, but spoke to Aeneas after his return. He suggested, Latinus had a good deal of tact himself, that the boy be given a domain to rule, away from both Laurentum and Lavinium. My father called Ascanius the boy, and greeted him as son of Aeneas, whereas he called his grandson Silvius, and greeted him as little king. His tact didn't prevent him from being very stubborn. Aeneas acted promptly on the suggestion. He offered Ascanius the governorship of the region of the Alban Hills, Lake Albanus, the village of Alba Longa, and the old city of Velitrae. He told him that his job there was to keep the peace with restless neighbors, so that the religious festivals of Mount Alba, to which people came from all over South Italy, could be held in safety, and to see to the improvement of agriculture and the training of a loyal body of farmer soldiers in the service of the Latin kings. He told me he had been blunt with his son, warning him that if he stirred up trouble instead of preventing it, he would be summoned back to Lavinium and deprived of command. Ascanius went off with his bosom friend Attis and a tiny army, all mounted on good horses and well-armed, helmet plumes nodding, proud and handsome. He stayed in Alba Longa and sent satisfactory reports to his father. The experiment appeared to be successful. It was a great relief to me to have him gone. I would have Aeneas to myself, and unworried by his son, all the rest of the summer, the autumn, the winter. I didn't think about the spring. Spring would come. Janus would open the gates, and Mars would bring it in as ever. I needn't think about it. Cattle rustlers and bands of brigands, poor men from Rutulia and the hill country east of Latium, were a perpetual threat to outlying farms. The Aequians and Sabines, who lived up the Tiber and its tributary, the Allia, harassed Evander's settlement and sometimes sailed down the Father River in their war canoes, hoping to raid the salt beds, so that Aeneas had manned ships anchored at his old camp at Venticula to chase them off. But these were no more than the troubles my father had always had, and Latium was as much at peace again as when I was a child. Aeneas could give his mind to building and farming and flocks and herds, to hunting, which he loved, as his son did, and to the ever-recurring rituals, which he loved as I did. We who are called royal are those who speak for our people to the powers of earth and sky, as those powers transmit their will through us to the people. We are go-betweens. The chief duty of a king is to perform the rites of praise and placation as they should be performed, to observe care and ceremony, and so understand and make known the will of the powers that are greater than we are. It is the king who tells the farmer when to plow, when to plant, when to harvest, when the cattle should go up to the hills, and when they should return to the valleys, as he learns these things from his experience and his service at the altars of earth and sky. In the same way, it is the mother of the family who tells her household when to rise, what work to do, what food to prepare and cook, and when to sit to eat it. Having learned these things from her experience and her service at the altars of her Lares and Penates. So peace is maintained, and things go well, in the kingdom and in the house. Both Aeneas and I had grown up in this responsibility, and it was dear to us both. He and Latinus divided their royal duties harmoniously, the younger man always deferring to the old man, but ready to take the burden from him if he tired. Not all our Latin customs were familiar to Aeneas, the Trojan, but he took up our rituals as if born to them, and performed them with a ready grace. I remember him as he led the Ambarvalia that spring, the bright spring. Every farmer was doing the same rite on his own land, leading his own household through the ceremony. Latinus would be going to his land under the walls of Laurentum, while Aeneas led the procession down from Lavinium to the royal fields. During the days before, we had done a good deal of work in the house to prepare, washing the white clothes everybody wore. They must be washed in running water, which meant a lot of trips down to the river, and gathering good herbs, lucky herbs, and weaving them into garlands for both people and animals. Everyone who participated was supposed to refrain from sex the night before and come to the ceremony chaste. The silence was what I had always loved best about Ambarvalia. Nobody spoke. People, like animals, walked saying nothing. It wasn't actually a requirement, but because any word spoken would carry unearthly weight, and a word said amiss might bring disaster to the crops and beasts, it was easier and better not to speak at all. Only the king and his assistants in the ceremony spoke, with the lucky tongue, almost inaudibly, repeating the litanies which old Ferox lined out for them a few words at a time, his voice soft and expressionless. Ferox had farmed this piece of land long before we built Lavinium near it. He had known the litanies and led the circumambulation of the fields for 60 years. He was the true lord of the rites. Aeneas followed him, leading a white lamb wreathed about with the leaves of fruit trees and wild olive, and we all followed after, clear around the field 3 times, from boundary stone to boundary stone, facing Janus and turning our backs on him as he faced and turned his back on us. We walked in silence, so that we heard the sound of our garments and our bare feet on the ploughland, and our breathing, and the birds singing the spring in, up in the oak groves. Then Aeneas led the lamb to the old stone altar, topped with a fresh turf of grass, and made the sacrifice. You can tell a great deal about a man from how he performs sacrifice. Aeneas's hands on the leggy ram lamb were calm and gentle, his knife stroke sudden and sure. The lamb went down softly on its knees, and then it sighed, as if it were lying down to sleep, dead before it could be frightened. During the sacrifice, old Ferox prayed aloud, telling the spirits of the place that as we now, with our gift of life, increase their numen, their power itself, so we asked them to give us increase and keep harm from the planted fields. And then, with other old men, loud and harsh, he sang the Arval song. Be with us, Lares. Help us. Let no harm come. No harm come, Mars. Mars of the wild, eat your fill. Eat your fill, Mars. Leap on the boundary stone. Eat your fill, Mars. Stand on the boundary stone. Call the interceders to plead for us. Be with us, Mars. Dance now, dance now, dance now, dance now, dance. So we had drawn the silent circle of protection around the fields, and prayed to the implacable power of the place and season, and now came the dancing, and the feasting, and the carols and love songs. Of that song Ferox and the old men sang, Aeneas told me he had never heard anything like it, nor had he known the Mars we know. The Mars of his people was a bringer of war and disorder only, not a guardian of the herds and flocks, not the power that holds the thin boundary between the tame and the wild. He asked the old men about the song and about Mars, and I know he pondered over what they said. He hadn't known the song in far-off Troy, but my poet had known it in far-off Mantua, across the mountains, in the dark of time to come, hundreds of years after I first heard it sung. That night in Albunea, when we talked about our households and our ways, I asked the poet if his people kept Ambarvalia, and he smiled at me and sang, to the tune that was ancient even when I knew it. Enos, Lases, Juvate. Be with us, Lares. Help us. Mars's time is the season of the farmer and the warrior, spring and summer. In October, the lances and shields of the leapers are put away. War ends as the harvest comes home. That year, Latinus held the October horse ceremony, the only time we sacrifice a horse except at the funeral of a king. People came from all over Latium for it, grateful for the peace of the realm and the excellence of the harvest. It was the last great ceremony held at Laurentum. We went there to stay several days, and Aeneas assisted my father in the rites. I could no longer do so, since my marriage, for I wasn't the daughter of his household any longer, being the mother of my own. But little Silvius, Latinus's heir, was allowed to take the plate of sacred food from the table to the hearth after dinner, and cast the food into the vestal fire. Maruna's mother went with him and prevented him from dropping the plate as well as the food into the fire.
"Only the beans, Silvius," she whispered.
And he, very solemn, said,
"Only bees."
He was supposed to say, "The gods are favorable," but we said it for him. That was a good autumn, rich and mild, and the winter rains were long and soft. In the press of daily occupation and obligation, and the continual delights and anxieties of caring for Silvius, and unfailing joy and pleasure of Aeneas's companionship and love, I lost track of the passage of the days. They were all one day and long, blessed night. But once in a while I would wake for no reason deep in the winter darkness, my body and soul as cold as the ice on the river's edge, thinking, "This is the third winter." Then I would lie awake, and my mind would gnaw and gnaw at the puzzle I couldn't solve. The poet had told me that Aeneas would rule for 3 summers and 3 winters. Was the summer we married the first of the 3 summers? I thought that because it was half gone before he came to rule in Lavinium, the count of 3 summers and 3 winters should begin with the winter of that year, and the summer that lay before us now would be his third and last. But at least he would have till the summer, through the summer. He wouldn't die this spring. But why must he die? Perhaps the poet hadn't meant that at all. The poet hadn't said he would die, only that his reign would be 3 years. Perhaps he would give up the kingship, give it to Ascanius, and live on, a long life, a happy life, the life he deserved. Why had I not thought of that before? The idea filled my mind and dazzled me so I could sleep no more. And in the morning, when he woke, I could scarcely keep myself from bursting out to him, "Give your kingdom to your son, Aeneas." I had sense enough not to do that. But in a day or two, I did ask, trying to speak lightly, if he had ever thought of laying his rule aside and living as an ordinary man. He looked at me quickly, a flash of his dark eyes.
"That choice wasn't offered me," he said. "Priam's nephew, Anchises' son."
"But now you're in a land where your fathers are less important than your sons, perhaps."
"If I grant that," he said after considering it. "What then?"
"I was sent here to be king. Hector came from his grave. Creusa rose from her death to tell me what I had to do. I was to take my people to the western land and rule, and marry there and have a son. You can't say I don't do my duty, Lavinia." He had spoken somberly at first, but he ended with a half-suppressed smile. "No one would ever say that of you. But you have done it. You carried out the prophecy. You fulfilled your destiny. Hard as it was, voyaging over sea, the storms and shipwrecks, and losing friends and having to fight a war when you finally got here. And you have reigned and founded your dynasty. Do you never think of saying, 'Now I've done that. Now let me stand aside. Let me rest a while. Now I've come to harbor.'" He gazed at me for some time, a direct, mild, thoughtful gaze. He was thinking why I said what I had said, and finding no answer.
"Silvius is still rather short to stand aside for," he said finally.
It made me laugh. I was very tense. "Yes, he is. But Ascanius..."
"You want Ascanius to rule Lavinium?" He was surprised into sternness for a moment. Then his expression changed, became tender. He thought he knew why I was asking him to step down. "Lavinia, dear wife, you mustn't fear for me so much. It's less dangerous to be the king than to be a common soldier. Anyway, the day of our death isn't in our hands. There is no safe place. You know that."
"Yes, I know that."
He came to hold and comfort me, and I held him close. "Truly," he asked, "you'd give up being queen to spare me the trouble of being king?" I hadn't, in fact, actually thought about that aspect of my plan. He went on. "Who would take your place? We'd have to get Ascanius married off." He was teasing me by now. He knew that the idea of handing over my people and my penates to a strange woman would be dreadful to me. I was distressed and ashamed, feeling I had been caught in a lying trick, a stupid ruse. I couldn't speak, but blushed the way I do, turning red all over. He saw and felt that, and kissed me, gently at first, but with arousing passion. We were in the small courtyard of our house, no one about. "Come on, come," he said, and still red as fire, I followed him into our bedroom, where the conversation took a different form. But after that day, I was never able to put the poet's words wholly out of mind. They were always in my thoughts, underneath my thoughts, like the dark streams that run underground. There must be some way in which the words didn't mean that Aeneas was to die after 3 summers and winters as king in Latium, but meant only that his rule would end. Maybe he would conquer a neighboring country and rule as king of the Volscians or the Harnacae. Maybe he would take me and Silvius back to his own country and rebuild the beautiful city of Ilium that Achates and Serestus told me about, with its walls and towers and high citadel, and rule there as king of Troy. Maybe he wouldn't die, only be very ill, weakened by illness, so that Ascanius must come and take on the active role of kingship for him and be called king. That Aeneas would live on with me in Lavinium and have joy in his son and in his life. He would live. He wouldn't die. So my mind ran from possibility to possibility like a hare dodging hounds, while the 3 old women, the fates, spun out the measured thread of what was to be. The winter was mild, but long. January was all rain and mud. A portent occurred in Laurentum. The doors of the war gate, which my mother had opened, and I and Maruna and the men of the city had closed 3 years ago, swung open of themselves. People came to Janus's altar in the morning of the calends of February and found the gates hanging ajar. The bolts of the iron hasps that held in place the great locking beam had rusted through, so that the hasps gave way and let the beam drop. The hinges also were rusted and askew, so that the gates couldn't be closed. Latinus was gravely troubled by the omen. He didn't think it right to interfere, to repair the hinges and the hasps, until the meaning of the event became clear. No one knew why they had been made of iron, the unlucky metal, never used in sacred places. He had his smiths make new hasps and bolts and hinges of bronze, but he didn't mend or close the war gate yet. Troubling news was coming in from east and south of the Alban Hills. Farmers and villagers along the border reported ambushes, barn burning, cattle thieving, and harassment, carried on by both sides, Latin and Rutulian. And young Commars of Ardea, who had led the inept attack on our city 2 years before, sent to us to complain that his city was being threatened and its farms and pastures constantly raided by men from Alba Longa. I watched Aeneas master his bitter, disappointed anger. He was like a man mounted on a powerful horse that fights the reins and plunges, nose to feet, and kicks, twisting its body, and finally is brought to stand white with sweat, shaking, ready to obey. My heart felt as if it was being squeezed in a fist of fear. But now that the time had come, my empty imaginings of escape all died away and left me to face what there was no escaping. When he said, "I must go down to Ardea," I made no protest and tried to show no undue fear. He went fully armed and with a strong escort. He wasn't taking any unnecessary risks, only necessary ones. I kissed him goodbye and held up Silvius for his kiss and smiled and bade him come home soon. "I will come home soon," he said, "with Ascanius." My best friends among Aeneas's friends, Achates and Serestus, had ridden away with him. I was left with my women. They were of great comfort to me. They helped me keep everything in the household and the city running on as it should. Serestus's wife, Olivia, had just had a baby, and we could forget our worries playing with him. My father sent a man down daily to ask if we had news and if we needed advice or help. He didn't come himself, for he had been troubled with a cough all winter, and the weather was foul, with hard rains and the ways deep in mud. Nor did I go to him, for I was needed in my city. Those were 9 long, dark days and nights. At evening of the day after the Ides of February, a troop of wet men on wet horses tramped up out of the rainy dusk to the city gate. The guardsmen cried out, "The king! King Aeneas comes!" He rode in, his sword on his hip and the great shield on his shoulder. Behind him rode Ascanius, unarmed. Then Aeneas's men, all armed. My relief and joy at seeing him, embracing him, was so great it set all else aside. I felt that night that to have known such fulfillment was to be, in some part of my being, forever safe from absolute despair, from the ruin of the soul. Joy, my shield. I don't know if that is true, but I wouldn't deny it, even later, even now. Everything was bustle at first, getting baths and food for the tired men. Aeneas had time to tell me that he had patched up a month's truce with Camers and brought Ascanius back to talk about what went wrong. Serestus and Nestheus were left in charge of Alba Longa and the restive borderlands. Ascanius had indeed caused most of the trouble, by claiming as Latin ground certain winter pastures used by the Rutulians, and putting settlers in a stream valley the Rutulians considered their summer pasture, and sending his soldiers to harass any Rutulians who crossed the border. Since the border was a vague one in many places, and traditionally porous, these were sure means of rousing bad feeling. Camers attempts to protect Rutulian farmers by sending out armed men, and resulted in some bloody skirmishes and much menacing talk from Ascanius about leveling the walls of Ardea, to which Camers responded by threatening to annex Velitrae and obliterate Alba Longa. Achates told me about the meeting with Camers. He praised Aeneas's peacemaking skill, which, as he described it, consisted in saying almost nothing. Camers had wanted to come round, but couldn't admit it. His failed attack had left him sore, chastened, ready to let well enough alone. But Ascanius had been making boasts and threats which he wouldn't endure. Aeneas listened patiently to a long list of offenses, without either apologizing for them or justifying them, before he could even suggest a truce. Achates said he had been so patient and so firm that Camers, who wasn't much older than Ascanius, ended up talking to him, the man who had killed Khamer's father in the battle before Laurentum, as to a father. So the truce was made, and made in good faith, though both Achates and Aeneas thought that Khamer's would have a problem controlling the rough farmers of his borderlands. Aeneas's problem, evidently, was how to control his son. Although Ascanius had been brought back in apparent disgrace, nothing was said of it that night. He was made welcome at the impromptu feast we set out for the homecomers. He showed neither shame nor defiance, but behaved much as usual. He had been very well trained in manners, and they stood him in good stead at a time like this. He must have been puzzling over the question of what Aeneas was finally going to say or do. So was I. But the evening went off cheerily enough, and father and son embraced, as they used to, at parting for the night. And the question continued unanswered. Aeneas had done what he had said he'd do, deprive Ascanius of command and bring him back to Lavinium. And that was all. He said nothing. He wasn't a man to waste words. He did, and let be. He spoke when he had to. Ascanius stewed quite a while, fretted, sulked, and once or twice tried to bring the situation to a head. Aeneas evaded his attempts. The nearest he would come to discussing Ascanius's position was through a kind of running conversation they had about virtue. Manly virtue, that is, in the original sense of the word. Manliness itself. Manhood. Ascanius said one day, with his youthful pompousness, that the only true proof of manhood was in battle. True virtue was skill in fighting, courage to fight, will to win, and victory. Aeneas said, "Victory? What's the use of skill and courage if you're dead?" Hector had no virtue? Of course he did. He won all his battles, till the last one. "We all do," Aeneas remarked. That was a little beyond Ascanius, perhaps, and the subject was dropped. But Aeneas brought it up again soon, at dinner one day. "So a man can prove his manhood only in war," he said meditatively. "A certain kind of manhood," Achates suggested. "Surely wisdom is as much a virtue as battle prowess." "But perhaps one that isn't limited to men," I said. I will say here that the Trojans hadn't been used to including women in conversation, nor were any Greeks I ever met. For men and women to sit together at table and speak as equals was our Latin custom, which I think we may have learned from the Etruscans. As queen, I could have my way in such matters. Some of the rougher Trojans needed a lesson in respect, in table manners, which they got both from Aeneas and from me. But others, like Achates and Serestus, took to this as to our other customs, without any trouble. When I invited them to the Regia, their wives came with them, and sat with us above the salt, and often I invited the women to come when their husbands were away. "Indeed, women can gain wisdom," Ascanius announced with his irritating, touching pomposity. "But not true virtue."
"But what is piety?" Aeneas asked.
That brought a thoughtful silence.
"Obedience to the will of the powers of earth and sky?" I said at last, making my statement a question, as women so often do.
"The effort to fulfill one's destiny," Achates said.
"Doing right," said Olivia, Serestus's wife, a calm, forceful woman from Tusculum, who had become one of my dearest friends.
"What is right in battle, in war?" Aeneas asked.
"Skill,"
Courage? Strength? Ascanius answered promptly. In war, virtue is piety, fighting to win.
So victory makes right?
Yes, Ascanius said, and several of the men nodded vigorously. But the older Trojans, some of them, didn't. Nor did the women.
I can't make it out, Aeneas said in his quiet voice. I thought what a man knew he ought to do was what he must do. But what if they're not the same? Then, to win a victory is to be defeated. To uphold order is to cause disorder, ruin, death. Virtue and piety destroy each other. I can't make it out.
Even Ascanius had no answer for that. I doubt if anyone there knew what was on Aeneas's mind when he said that to obey one's fate might be to disobey one's conscience. Only I could know how the death of Turnus weighed on his soul. I know Achates thought he was speaking of the Greek victory over Troy in a war which, though they might be justified in waging it, brought almost as much ruin on the Greeks as on the Trojans. Perhaps he was. At any rate, he didn't let Ascanius's definition of manhood as battle courage rest. He returned to the discussion next day. We had no visitors, and the three of us had gathered around the hearth after the day's work was done. I, with my distaff, Aeneas, with a little whetstone and my small ritual knife, which had grown dull. He drew it lightly and patiently across the stone.
If a man believes his virtue can be proved only in war, he said to Ascanius, then he sees time spent on anything else as wasted. Farming, if he's a farmer. Government, if he's a ruler. Worship, the acts of religion, all inferior to prowess in war.
Yes, just so, Ascanius said, pleased, thinking he had convinced his father.
I wouldn't trust that man to farm, or govern, or serve the powers that rule us, Aeneas said, because whatever he was doing, he'd seek to make war.
Ascanius got the drift now, and recoiled uneasily. Not necessarily, he began.
Necessarily, Aeneas said, with grim finality. I spent my life among such men, Ascanius. I proved my virtue among them.
Yes, you did, father. You were the best among them all. There were tears in Ascanius's eyes, and his voice trembled.
Except for Hector, Aeneas said. And on the other side, Achilles, the great hero, and Diomedes, who both defeated me. I would probably have lost to Odysseus, big Ajax, maybe Agamemnon. I think I could have beaten Menelaus. And what if I had? Would I be a better man for it? Would my virtue be greater than it is? Am I who I am because I killed men? Am I Aeneas because I killed Turnus?
He was leaning forward. The firelight gleamed in his eyes. He didn't raise his voice, but spoke with terrible intensity. Ascanius cowered back from him, catching his breath.
If you are to rule Latium after me, and pass it to your brother Silvius, I want to know that you'll learn how to govern, not merely make war, that you'll learn to ask the powers of earth and sky for guidance for yourself and your people, that you'll learn to seek your manhood on a greater field than the battlefield. Tell me that you will learn those things, Ascanius.
I will, father.
The young man said,
in tears.
"Much depended on me,"
Aeneas said more gently.
"Much will depend on you. In the end, I did ill. You have begun ill, but I count on you to do well in the end. So, give me your hand on it, son."
Ascanius put out his hand, and Aeneas drew him into an embrace. They clung hard to each other. I sat with my distaff, my face turned to the fire. I couldn't weep. A few days later, just before the March Calends, Aeneas sent Ascanius back to the Alban Hills. He said nothing about honoring the truce with Comares. There was no use saying more. He could only hope. He looked a little grim, those early days of March, when the leapers were in the streets shaking the sacred spears and singing, "Mars, Mavors, Macte Esto." But Serestus and Nestius came back from Alba Longa, reporting that everything was quiet and that Ascanius seemed resolved to keep it so. It was a warm spring after the wet winter. Everything was early to bloom and bare. The walnut trees in the forests were beautiful in their quick flowering. Barley and millet came up tall, with heavy heads, and the grass was as thick and tender in the meadows and on the hillsides as I ever saw it. Our flocks and herds had a good increase, and Aeneas was particularly pleased with the crop of new foals in our stables. He had bred a very fine mare to the stallion Latinus gave him, and the bright chestnut colt she bore was his pride.
"He'll be Silvius's horse," he said,
and he introduced the boy child and the horse child quite solemnly. He let Silvius lead the mare about and see how the colt followed him, and finally set him up on her back for a ride. Silvius was transfixed with terror and delight, clutching the mare's mane with one hand and his father's hand with the other, and making a soft noise, "Ooh, ooh," like a pigeon, as they paraded round the stable yard. After that, every morning he would ask his father timidly, "Wide?" And Aeneas would go with him to the stables for his ride. Our people, my Latins of Lavinium, called Aeneas father.
"Will that fence do, Father Aeneas?"
"Father, the barley's in."
They spoke to Latinus the same way, and young as I was Mother Lavinia. For we use the words not only for our parents, but for those who take responsibility for us. Often a soldier calls his captain his father, and rightly, too, if the captain looks after his men as he should. But Aeneas's people used the word to him in a particularly affectionate way, caressingly, claiming him. The duty that had been laid on him to lead his people had isolated him as their leader. After his father's death, he had had to make the decisions alone, take responsibility alone. So this bond of affection meant a great deal to him. He tried to deserve it. He took his actual fatherhood with the same seriousness and deep pleasure. It was beautiful to see him walk with Silvius, shortening his stride to the child's, ever careful of the child's dignity. I knew he had greatly honored his own father. He never spoke of his mother, and I don't know if he ever knew her. It was with some caution that I asked him about his own early childhood.
"I don't remember much," he said. "I was with women, in the woods, on the mountain, a group of women living in the forest."
"Were they kind to you?"
"Kind? Careless? They let me run about. I'd get into trouble, and one of them would come and laugh and scoop me up.
I was wild as a bear cub.
Then your father came for you?
He nodded. A lame man, in armor. I was afraid of him. I remember I tried to hide in the thickets. But the women knew my hiding places. They scooped me up again and handed me over to him.
So after that you lived with him?
And learned farming and manners and all that.
When did you go to Troy?
Priam had us come, sometimes. He never liked us.
He gave you his daughter,
I said, surprised. He didn't exactly give her,
Aeneas answered, but he didn't want to say any more about Creusa, and I didn't press him. After a little while, he said,
It's a good place for a child, the woods. You don't learn much about people, but you learn silence, patience, and that there's nothing much to fear in the wilderness, less than there is on a farm or in the city.
I thought of Albunea, that fearful place where I had never been afraid. I almost asked him to come there with me, but I didn't. Though it was so nearby, I hadn't been there since our marriage. I wanted to go, and yet it didn't seem the time. I found I couldn't imagine being there with him, so I said nothing of it. The weather was so mild in late March that we went over to the coast, a walk of a couple of miles. I wanted Silvius to have a first sight of the ocean. Aeneas carried him perched on his shoulder most of the way. We were a large group winding through the dunes, slaves carrying picnic food, several families, a few extra young men as guards. Everybody, slave and free, children and grown, scattered out on the pale yellow beach as soon as we got there, wading, gathering shells, enjoying the sunlight. Aeneas and I wandered off from the others, leaving Silvius with a group of adoring women and Maruna to keep them from spoiling him. We walked a long way down the shore. I could seldom get out to walk, as I used to these days, and it was a wonderful pleasure to step out barefoot on the sand, splashing through the small streams that ran down to the sea, keeping pace with my husband's even, untiring stride. The sea made its emotionless lament to our right, looking out over the low breakers to the wave glitter that dissolved in the mist of the horizon. I said, How far you came, across that sea, the other seas, years, miles.
How far I came to come home, he said.
After a while I said, though until the moment I said it, I hadn't been perfectly certain of it. Aeneas, I'm carrying a child.
He walked on for a while, a smile slowly spreading over his face, then stopped, and stopped me by taking my hands and took me in a close embrace. A girl, he said, as if I would know, and I rashly answered, A girl. All I want you give me, he said, hugging the breath nearly out of me, kissing my face and neck. Dark one, dear one, wife, girl, queen, my Italian, my love. There were some rocks running down from inland that would hide us from anyone coming down the shore, and we tugged each other towards them. In their shelter, we made love, rather hastily and with a good deal of laughter at first, because of sand where it wasn't wanted, but with a rising wild passion, so that at the height of it I felt that he had made me one with the sea and its tides and its deeps. When we came back to the world, he lay there on the sand by me, and he was so beautiful I couldn't look away from him. I touched his breast and arms and face softly with my fingertips, and he lay half asleep in the sunlight, smiling.
We got up and walked out into the water, waist deep, hand in hand, till the cold struck through and the tug of the waves began to take us off our feet. "Let's go on, let's go on," I said. But I was frightened, too. Aeneas suddenly swung me round, half carrying me back to the shore. Then we wandered back to the others. Silvius had fallen asleep under a little awning the women had made out of scarves. There was sand in his small, arched eyebrows, and his face in the pale radiance under the white cloths was very serious. I lay down by him and whispered his name to him, the name I called him secretly. Aeneas Silvius. Aeneas Silvius. I can't tell any more of our happiness. Early in April, Aeneas went down to Alba Longa overnight and reported that all was well there. Late in April, my father came to visit us for some days. May came. The day came that I was at the mouth of Tiber 3 years ago at dawn and saw the dark ships turn and come up the river one by one. That day, Aeneas went, with Achates and our chief herdsman and 4 or 5 young men, looking for a small herd of our cattle that had escaped their pasture east of town, crossed the Numicus at the ford, and were thought to be wandering down towards Troia. These were our finest cows and heifers, and we didn't want them scattered or lost. The men found the herd and drove them back to the river. A group of men from Rutulia had stolen the cattle, or perhaps was following them to steal them. These men attacked Aeneas and the others while they were at the ford of the Numicus. They were armed with spears and staves. Several of Aeneas's men had weapons, and though outnumbered, fought back fiercely, killing 2 of the outlaws at once. The Rutulians fell back and ran, all but a young man whom Aeneas had pinned down, his sword at the man's throat. The young man begged, "Don't kill me! Don't kill me!" Aeneas hesitated, then turned his sword aside and said, "Go on." The young man struggled up and ran off. He stopped and picked up a spear another man had dropped. He turned and threw it. It hit Aeneas in the back and went through his chest. He fell to his knees and then face down in the shallow water of the ford. He didn't die at once, but he was dead when they carried him into Lavinium, into the Regia, into the courtyard, where I was looking through our new cloth, the winter's weaving, that had been bleaching on the grass outside the walls. I had picked out a fine piece as a toga for him. Unaccustomed to wearing the toga, he often found it cumbersome. I was folding the light, soft, pure white cloth when I heard them calling out his name and mine. "Go on. Go." In our tongue, it is a single sound, E. It is the last word Aeneas said. So in my mind it is spoken to me, said to me. I am the one to go on. Go where? I don't know. I hear him say it, and I go. On, away, on the way to go. When I stop, I hear him say it, his voice, go on. In Lavinium all that night, they cried his name aloud, calling him father, lamenting in the streets. Achates, Serestus, Nestheus gathered the men of Troy at first dawn and rode to Ardea, scouring the countryside on the way. They didn't find the cattle thieves, but comrades of Ardea knew who they were and where to look for them. He rode with the Trojans. They rode the men down and killed them all. They were farmers' sons from northern Rutulia, led by a couple of Etruscans who had come with Mezentius to Ardea, bitter, leaderless men living in exile. I had sent a rider on our best horse, Aeneas's horse, to Ascanius in Alba Longa. Ascanius arrived in Lavinium on the second day, and late that day the Trojans came back. Our house, that had been full of weeping women, was full now of grim armed men. I didn't let them put armor on Aeneas. All that gear of bronze and gold and the great shield that held the fearful future should go to Ascanius and then to Silvius. I washed his body, noble and terrible in death, scar-seamed. I clothed him in the toga of our people, the fine white one I had chosen for him. When many die, as in plague or war, we burn the dead. But our older way is burial under earth. I ordered that Aeneas's grave be beside the road above the ford of the Numicus. There he was carried, the torches flaring and smoking in the rainy wind of a May morning. Latinus spoke the ritual words. Men heaped up the river rocks into a great barrow over the grave. When all was done, I stood and called his name aloud 3 times. Aeneas! 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 And the other people called his name with me. Then, in silence, carrying the dead torches upside down, we walked back to his city. On the 9th day after his death, Latinus performed the sacrifice of kings, killing the beautiful stallion he had given Aeneas by the tomb of rocks. The horse was buried by the tomb. On that day also he named Ascanius king of Latium, to share the rule with him as Aeneas had. It was necessary that Latinus lend his succession all the weight of his authority, and that I, too, demand that my people recognize Ascanius as king, for they didn't want him. He had antagonized them from the beginning. It was he who shot Silvia's deer. They never forgot that. He had been arrogant, quarrelsome, aloof, seeming much more a foreigner than his father. My people in Lavinium wanted Latinus to rule them, wanted me there in the Regia, bringing up Silvius, their little one, their prince, their king-to-be. They stood sullen, with tear-streaked faces, while Latinus proclaimed Ascanius king. In the days of mourning, Ascanius had for the first time appealed to me for support. He found I could give it to him, and he came to me to weep. During the ceremonies he looked and acted what he was, a boy overwhelmed by grief, dismayed, distressed, terrified by the responsibility he must bear. Accepting the kingship and making his vows to the people and the land, he spoke in a barely audible voice, trembling. At one point I had to say to him softly, "King of the Latins, hold up your head." He obeyed. I don't know what the strength was that carried me through that time. I suppose I am one of my people, made of oak. Oaks don't bend, though they can break. And I had known what was coming. I had lived with Aeneas's death a long time, from the time I first saw his face, high on the ship's prow, dark in the twilight of morning, gazing up the river in prayer and eager hope. 3 years, the poet had said. 3 years to the day it was. The 3 old women who spin and cut the thread had measured exactly, to the inch, nothing to spare. No gift of summer days.